Well, this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the publication of one of the most influential theses in the modern era. It's called The End of History. It was by the recently departed US State Department head of policy planning, and his name was Francis Fukuyama. And his argument that the world had reached the end point of humankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of market democracy. Now, for decades, it was widely held that capitalism would not just lead to China's economic progress, and that's evidently happened, but eventually it would lead to democratic change. As a result, China's rise would be benign and peaceful. Well, many people believe that Beijing has not really followed the end of history script, has it? Especially in the Xi Jinping era. So the question here today is, have we in the West been naive about China? And what does all this mean for Canberra's relations with Beijing in the Xi era? Well, we have a great debate. John Lee is a former senior advisor to Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, and he's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington and also with the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. And James Lawrenson is the director of the Australia-China Relations Institute here in Sydney. Welcome to the show, guys.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, Tom.
Now, John, the conventional wisdom in the 80s and the 90s, and even in the 2000s, was that the more capitalist and prosperous China would become, the more liberal and democratic China would become. If anything, China's become more authoritarian. Were we in the West naive?
Well, we looked at the recent history in East Asia, in countries like Japan and Taiwan and South Korea, and we looked at what happened to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And we saw a pattern there. But we were naive about the capacity of the Communist Party in China to adapt. They clearly are keen students of history. They learnt from history as to why authoritarian regimes collapse, and they adapted.
Well, on Xi, I mean, because this is where this narrative, the Fukuyama narrative, has really been blown apart in many respects. James Xi, when he became General Secretary in, was it 2012, he was seen as a consensus advocate, much like his recent predecessors. He hasn't turned out like that. In fact, he's the most powerful leader since Mao Zedong. How do you account for that?
Well, the way I account for it is I think it may have been the conventional hope that China would become like us, but I'm not so sure it was ever the conventional wisdom outside of places like Washington and Canberra. Certainly many of my academic colleagues in Australia have been talking for decades that this idea that all countries will eventually end up like us is a little bit silly, because every country is a sample of one. They've got their own history, culture, political economy. So I think it was a bit of a flawed thesis to start with.
But then again, Taiwan and South Korea have turned their economic freedoms into political freedoms, right, John?
Well, first of all, Taiwan and South Korea are far smaller countries. They're much more reliant on the United States for their security and strategic health. The United States had far more leverage over these countries. And if we look back in history, the United States did use that leverage to push gradual institutional and eventually political reforms over time. China was always a different kettle of fish. Even back in 2010, I think through the Center for Independent Studies, I released a paper with the title, Why China Will Not Be a Responsible Stakeholder. My point is that China always had a different conception of itself in the world. So from that point of view, it shouldn't be surprising where China is today.
Okay, and following on from John's point, his old boss, Julie Bishop, in Singapore 2 years ago warned that China would never reach its full potential unless it embraces democracy. Many Westerners reflect her thoughts. Why can't China just embrace democracy, James?
It probably doesn't need to embrace democracy to achieve its economic wants, right? Look, I know Julie Bishop said that. I don't think it was correct. Do you know why I don't think it's correct? Because you can look at many parts of China now that have, in fact, reached high income status. In 2012, there were only three cities in China, Beijing, Shanghai, and Tianjin, that had reached high income status. They were joined by Jiangsu and Zhejiang last year. This year, they're being joined by Guangzhou and Hainan. So that's up to 300 million people now in China who have reached high income status. So I think China itself is proving the argument wrong that a country with that sort of political system can't reach high income status.
And John, on that note, from Beijing's perspective, isn't there a fear of things getting out of hand and a return to the chaos and mass violence of really the relatively recent past, aren't they very real concerns? And if they embrace democracy, that would put more pressure on the central command in China.
If you embrace democracy, that is giving every individual a right to vote for multi-parties, if you embrace democracy by that definition without the building of civil institutions and social institutions, then clearly or certainly I think the chances of disorder in any country are pretty high. And we've seen that all around Asia and other parts of the world, that democracy in itself does not bring prosperity or order. Going back to Julie Bishop's speech and with relevance to your point, the point Julie Bishop was making was that you need liberal institutions, not necessarily one person, one vote, but you need liberal institutions for commerce to take place in a predictable way, for innovations to occur, to protect intellectual property, all those sorts of things that high-income economies have. So I think that was the point being made. And I do think that China is trying to install these institutions whilst not having democracy. Now, I'm skeptical they can do that in the long term, but of course, history will be the guide of that.
And in fairness to the Bishop Lee thesis, James Lawrenson, we have had Western reports showing cracks in Xi's authority over China. You've got intellectuals increasingly voicing criticism as analysts point to disharmony in the Communist Party. Do those reports reflect a serious trend against Xi's control?
There's no doubt in China that there are debates. Xi's made a lot of enemies, and sometimes these enemies and their views bubble to the surface. That said, I don't think there's any serious threat to Xi's position at the helm of the Communist Party.
But some would say that Xi's strengthening China's claim to be nationalists.
Yeah, so I don't buy that because I look at the data and I just don't see that in the evidence. There was a study at the United States Study Center a couple of years ago, in fact, that measured nationalism in the US, Australia, Japan, India and Indonesia. And in fact, China was just in the middle of the pack. It was less nationalistic than India and Indonesia. So again, we've got to come back to the data talk.
So nationalism is not the central legitimating idea of state power in China. John Lee.
I look at Beijing's external behaviour since in the Xi Jinping era. And one may call it nationalism, one may call it something else. But from what I see in terms of analysing the behaviour of Beijing, it's become a lot more assertive. It has pushed the envelope on long-held claims. It seems less regarding of either its reputation or of abiding by certain rules and certain laws. Now, I'm not quite sure whether nationalism is the right word, but from a behavioural point of view, certainly they're behaving like what strategists would call a chauvinistic nationalist country.
Is there a danger in this debate, James Lawrenson, that we're overlooking China's very real limitations and weaknesses?
Yeah, and indeed it does have real limitations and weaknesses. We could talk demographics, we could talk debt. That said, I think history shows us we're probably more likely to underestimate China's growth potential rather than overestimate it. I recall Gordon Chang's book in 2001, The Coming Collapse of China. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary. It still hasn't collapsed.
And David Shambar, the doyen of Sino-American relations, wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that a few years ago.
Correct, a few years ago. Still hasn't happened. You know, it's the world's second largest economy in US dollar terms, the world's largest economy in purchasing power terms. So I think that's possibly the greater danger we face.
Okay, but John, we've got a large and growing debt problem in China, endemic corruption, environmental concerns, demography. Are you so bullish as James?
Well, when you look at China's absolute size and decades of GDP growth, it's been impressive, but it started from a very low base. We still have to remember that China is still a lower middle income country per capita. If China does become a high income country with current institutions, it will be the first time ever.
My guests are James Lawrenson and John Lee, and we're chatting about the changing nature of the debate about China. And let's turn to Australia. John, Hugh White, distinguished professor of international relations at ANU, former defence policy planner, he argues that Australia will eventually move further away from the US and closer into China's strategic orbit as China's power increases and America's diminishes. Plausible thesis?
That may have been plausible 10 years ago when we have had a much more moderate view of what China wanted to achieve in the region. I don't think it's plausible now because Australia would not accept what China is seeking to do in places like the South China Sea, but even in places like the Indian Ocean, certainly places like the East China Sea. Hugh's thesis, I think, on the face of it, is a compelling one. But when we look at the region as a whole, if we look at American allies such as Japan, such as South Korea, Australia, Philippines, they're certainly not moving towards China's orbit, despite the economic relationship they have with China. I think Hugh is correct in that we're in for a period of increased contestation and tension, but I disagree about where Australia will
be. And add to John's point, I mean, you've got Vietnam, an old Cold War foe, clamouring for US security guarantees in the face of a rising China. James?
Right. You have a range of responses from a range of countries in Southeast Asia, and let's not forget that all of these countries have their own agency, have their own histories and political economies. So I remember a few months ago, there was a lot of excitement when Mahathir came to power again in Malaysia, and he said some tough things about China. A lot of Washington observers said, there you go, Southeast Asia is starting to push back. And then a couple months later, he's saying, well, actually, I'm happy to work with China, and sometimes I'd prefer to work with China rather than the US. So this is the world we live in, Tom. And I think in Australia, we just have to be sensitive to the fact that there's a lot of divergences around the region, and we need to take that into account in our own strategic decision-making.
Let's bring this debate closer to home in the question of domestic sovereignty. There's been a lot of reports, particularly on the ABC's Four Corners, about allegations of Beijing's interference in our politics. There are fears that the communist government pressures on academic freedom. There was a Lowy poll that came out a year or so ago. Three quarters of Australians, it said, say that Canberra allows, quote, too much investment from China, and that's especially in real estate and agriculture. John, what do you make of the changing nature of our debate towards China?
We as a country had a certain hope and expectation of China, which, as we discussed earlier, was probably naive. I think we realise now that China is not going to be that kind of country. China's not going to be like Japan or South Korea. Now, having realised that, I think there's a response now from the population against many actions and policies from the Chinese. And from a policy point of view, we have to be very careful to separate those things that truly impinge our national interests from those things that we just simply don't like.
James Lawrenson.
Yeah, I think actually in terms of this importance in policy responses, John and I actually have a lot in common. Let's be clear about a couple things. China does present challenges to Australia's national interests, and that can include untowards interference in Australia. So we need to respond to that. At the same time, we've got to make sure our responses are calibrated based on facts and evidence. And unfortunately, sometimes we do have commentary and analysis where the connection to facts and evidence is very loose. I think that's what we need to avoid. I think we also can have some confidence in our institutions, Tom. I mean, I'm thankful we've got a free and independent media. Mm-hmm. They're certainly aggressive in pursuing allegations of Chinese interference. So if the Chinese are interfering, we're pushing back pretty well.
On this program over the years, I've asked several distinguished Australian former policymakers their thoughts on the quote that we're about to hear. I've asked Alan Gingell, Kim Beazley, Peter Varghese, among others. Let's get your reactions to something that Professor John Mearsheimer, the doyen of foreign policy realism at the University of Chicago, this is what he told me about how Australia should respond in the event of increasing strategic competition between Beijing and Washington.
Well, I think in a scenario where China is even more powerful than it is today, and the United States is consumed putting together a balancing coalition to contain China, any country in East Asia that does not cooperate with the United States, and this would be especially true of a country like Australia, would feel the white heat of anger from Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam would go to great lengths to coerce the Australians or the Japanese or the Filipinos, whoever, into working with the United States to deal with China. The United States would be very angry if the Australians tried to sort of cut a side deal with the Chinese and cooperate with the Chinese and not work with the United States to contain China.
Professor John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago on Between the Lines a few years ago. John Lee.
I feel Professor Mearsheimer has the emphasis wrong and in a reverse fashion. As China becomes more powerful, as it's occurring now, the countries in a region will become increasingly desperate for America to lead a balancing coalition against China. And you're seeing that with Japan. You're seeing that with Australia, even countries like Singapore. If you look at the Asian countries in the region, what they do not want is an Asian hegemon. And that will occur if the United States does not lead a balancing or countering coalition. Mm. So I think Professor Mearsheimer has it the reverse way. I think regional countries will be desperate to invite the Americans in to play a far more robust
role. So as China's power increases, more of these states will feel that their integrity is being threatened and they'll call on Washington to be more assertive in the region. But can we be so sure America will be assertive in the Trump era, or even if a Democrat, a more isolationist, non-interventionist Democrat's in the White House? James Lawrenson.
Well, Tom, let me pretend to be Hugh White from the Australian National University, and that's what he would say. He would say, I'm sure we are. We would like the US to be more engaged in the region, but there's no reason to think they would be. We've seen a history. It's not just Trump. As you say, it's both sides of US politics that both, for example, rejected the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I think Hugh White would say, well, US interests in this region are not particularly large. They're overextended. So in the end, I don't think we can count on them.
James, John, a terrific debate. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Tom.
My pleasure.
John Lee from the Hudson Institute in Washington and the US Studies Centre in Sydney, and James Lawrenson from the Australia-China Relations Institute at UTS.